Senator from the 10th yield.
I do.
Senator from the 10th yields. Senator, you may proceed.
Good evening, Senator. I want to thank you for hanging on every word of my inquiry of the senator from Nottoway. I could see that you were listening very closely.
I was. I didn't hear a word you said.
Oh, just now?
I'm just going to straight up admit it. There's this thing with your voice, and it just something switches, and no, I'm joking. Senator, with all due,
I think Mr. Talhuber has a very clever description.
You mean the ray of boredom? Phenomenon.
What's that? The overpowering ray of boredom.
Yeah, the overpowering ray of boredom.
Not to be convinced with the ray of tedium.
No, I'm joking. No, I actually did hear a significant portion of it. I did get pulled off the floor just for a couple of minutes, but I did hear what you were saying. And I kind of wanted to, this is your inquiry. I was going to ask you a couple of questions. But
well, I no pride of authorship here. I'm happy to answer anything you want to ask me, Senator.
Okay. Well, no, I just, one of the questions, and I was going to inquire of the senator from Nottoway about this, but, one of the questions that I didn't quite understand. So if we have a year where revenue drops dramatically, like say it did over the last few years, and then we start to climb out, and we need, in my mind, based on the priorities that I find important, to start to play catch-up in some areas. So let's use, for instance, funding the foundation formula.
Right.
Would this restrict us from being able to get back to fully funding the formula? Would this put a cap that would prevent us from doing that? That's kind of the question I had.
Let me direct your attention to page 3 of the floor of the Senate substitute and line 22. And I think your concern may very well be valid, but let's look at the language and be sure of that. It states in sub 4, total state general revenue appropriations for any fiscal year may exceed total state general revenue appropriations for the immediately preceding fiscal year by more than the appropriations growth limit, which is to say CPI, only under the following conditions. And the first one is state of emergency. And I don't know if emergency is defined. We can go into that a little bit later. Emergency is defined as a state of affairs that requires the immediate appropriation of monies for the health, safety, and general welfare of the people.
Okay.
What that plays out like in the real world is a, fair and separate question. The second exception is a two-thirds vote of the House and Senate appropriating money to meet an emergency. So, and those both of those conditions have to be declared. So you have to have an emergency declared by the governor, and you have to have a supermajority in both chambers to fund the majority. So if, for instance, you had the governor declaring an emergency and 21 senators saying, we really ought to appropriate money for that, the answer would be under this, no, you can't. It takes two-thirds, so it would be the same as a veto override, only they would have to be, in essence, voting with the governor instead of against. So that,
I guess, and maybe this is just my fundamental, maybe I have a problem understanding this, but right now it's my understanding that our foundation formula, and that was passed in 2005, I believe, we are underfunding it right now. Is that correct?
We are.
And there has been an attempt by the governor and then, to a certain extent, the appropriators to try to play catch-up and get to that point. So it is your reading of this, then, that if we were trying to do that and this were already in place, we would not be able to catch up. We would just have to follow inflation. Now, how does that work, though? If we've got a formula that says we're supposed to be funding at a certain level and we're not funding at that certain level, are we then opening ourselves up to a lawsuit?
Potentially. I know that's such a lawyerly answer, isn't it?
But
potentially. It takes a filing fee plus a lawyer willing to sign the pleading, right? For that. But, meritorious lawsuit, separate question. Potentially. But so as to be certain that we're not misrepresenting what the SJR actually does here, let me direct your attention to sub 5, because I think it walks back a little bit from sort of the ratchet down concern that you had. On page 4 it says, total state general revenue appropriations limit shall not be reduced or increased if the amount of total state revenues for the prior fiscal year is less than the amount of total state revenue for the next preceding fiscal year, which is to say, if you have a situation where revenue is growing, where mm-hmm. prior fiscal year is less than the next preceding fiscal year, so revenue has to be growing, and in that case, the appropriations limit shall not be reduced or increased. That seems to me to state that it can only ratchet one way, and maybe the sponsor can clarify that. But if what we're saying is that you can't change the appropriations limit when revenue is growing, it seems to me that it's a one-way ratchet down. And if you have a depression followed by 10 years of explosive growth, you remain at depression revenue levels regardless of what growth in the economy you would have subsequently. And it may very well be that that's exactly the point, and that's the idea, and that's the intent, and that's what we're trying to do here, a one-way ratchet.
And then the senator from Nottoway then was saying that at that point, then the money would be returned to the hands of the taxpayer. Is that correct?
I think that's intent.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
And I'll say that's similar to Hancock. And, you know, I was talking with the senator from Nottoway about change in my region since 1980. You know, it's funny. We adopted the Hancock Amendment in 1980, and the aggregate population of the St. Louis metropolitan region today in 2014 is almost precisely the same as it was in 1980, which is to say, as a region, we have not had population growth in the almost 35 years since the Hancock Amendment was adopted. Now, people have moved around a lot. There have been some areas of the metro region that have grown exponentially. There have been some other areas that have done just the opposite. But we have about the same 2 million plus or minus people in the St. Louis metropolitan area today as we did when the Hancock Amendment was adopted. And the only reason it stayed at that level is because we've had the better part of 100,000 new Americans come into the St. Louis region, the overwhelming majority of them from the Bosnia and the former Yugoslavia republics. And so we've actually had to add a substantial immigrant influx just to avoid losing population since Hancock was adopted.
Okay.
And some would say that what this proposal does is to say, let's run that play again. And I'm talking about a correlation. I'm not suggesting causation between the Hancock Amendment and stagnation in St. Louis population growth. But it is interesting. And the senator, the sponsor is absolutely right. As a state, we have not grown at a pace commensurate with the rest of the country for a century plus now. One of my favorite, and this may be, you know, this may be apocryphal, but I had been somebody that I worked with in college, and I have not gone back to verify it, but suggested to me that over the 20th century, the course of the 20th century, every Missouri county that did not have an interstate highway running through it lost population between 1900 and 2000, with the only exception being Adair County, where you have the university.
Really?
And I have not gone back to the state manual. I have a great state manual collection. It does not go back to 1900. I have never looked at the numbers to verify whether that claim was correct. So for all I know, I am spinning a tale here. But at least one person who I have reason to believe knew what they were talking about suggested that in the 20th century, unless an interstate highway came through your county, you lost population over those 100 years. And so whatever the policy mix has been or has needed to be, whether it's, you know, the Hancock Amendment followed by Tabor, or followed by Farm Bureau Carnahan, followed by Tabor, or other policies that we've taken, some would say that we've, you know, increased our investment in education and that hasn't done it, et cetera. I mean, whatever we've been doing, we have not grown at the same rate as the rest of the country, and, you know, that matters. Our congressional delegation is half the size that it was, and we have half the clout we used to have in the United States House of Representatives. And again, that matters, and some would suggest that that has limited our ability to address it. But there are a number of states that have taken different policy approaches. I Colorado adopted Tabor recently. I don't know that, you know, we can attribute what's happened in Colorado over the last 35 years to a Tabor approach, but there certainly are other states that have grown relative, vis-a-vis Missouri noticeably in our respective lifetimes, and they've done it different ways. I don't know one that's done it by Tabor, though. And I don't know how many other states adopted anything like the Hancock Amendment over those 35 years.
Yeah, I don't know that either. I mean, I remember the first time I heard Tabor discussed, it was obviously as I was getting elected and then entering the legislature, there was a lot of talk about it. And it's been a bill that I've heard about on several occasions. I did understand that Colorado did pass that bill. It was also my understanding that, or that provision in their constitution, but I also understand that they suspended that provision. Is that accurate? Do you know the answer to that?
I had heard something along
those
lines.
That was the narrative that was
proposed
to me, that this happened in Colorado and then they changed their mind because it didn't work out the way they wanted it to.
One of the
concerns that I have clearly about that is, you know, I think there are some ideas that we should try. My fear is when you put things into the Constitution and you can't back out of them, that it's a dangerous place to go.
Well, in fairness to the sponsor, I believe there may be an escape clause in here that allows for a vote of the people, although I will confess I'm having a little difficulty putting my hands on it. So, I mean, I think I heard him represent that the people can vote to change the appropriation amount as they see fit.
I guess one of the concerns that I had, you know, we were talking a lot over the last 2 years, obviously, about the idea of whether Missouri should have a tax cut. If we have one, how big should it be? If there is one, what should we cut? You know, whose income should we cut, or taxes should we cut? And how do we pay for that and all those sorts of things? And one of the conversations that we had over and over and over again is, well, you know, we've got to compete with these states around us and make sure that
right.
we're competitive. And I'm very sympathetic to that.
I
understand that. I get that. I live, you know, near
yeah.
state line. I understand that.
Well,
I know,
we've been talking about the St. Louis region. A lot's happened in the Kansas City region over the last 35 years, and I spent many of them living in Kansas City, so I saw some of it happen. And a lot of it has been very good on the Missouri side. On the other hand, there's no question where much of the growth in that region has been over the last 35 years, and a lot of it's been on a side of the border that we're not on.
And so, I mean, I'm sensitive to that. I understand that. I want to be competitive with our other state. One of the concerns that I have is that, you know, Kansas doesn't have something like Hancock. So if their legislature comes up with a proposal that is not working, that they don't necessarily have to send it back to a vote of the people.
They can fix it legislatively.
They can fix it legislatively. We don't have those same benefits. And that's the thing that concerns me when we start to go down this road, because these things seem to be permanent changes. So even
yeah.
if we wanted to see whether this worked and sort of go incrementally, it doesn't do that. It's kind of all or nothing.
And
that's the piece that scares me a little
bit. Yeah, it's constitutional. And I think the senator from the 7th made precisely that point in debating the tax cut bill that came through the body last week, that because under current law, even without Tabor, we don't have the ability, if you will, to undo a tax cut, that puts us in a different place from many other states and gives us less options if down the road we find that we may need to revisit our course. And I think that's a very valid point. We're talking about constitutionalizing it. And I'll say, you know, at the congressional level, there have been any number of statutes adopted. Graham Rudman Hollings was probably the most prevalent one 80s and early 90s, and then you had the 1990 budget compromise, and then you got into a different administration and things changed some. But at the federal level, there has been an effort to rein in spending, and it's been statutory as opposed to constitutional. And there was talk, I think, after the change in control at the federal level in 1994 of a balanced budget amendment federally, which I think many believed would have had some of the same effects as this SGR we're debating now, and that, I think, failed by one vote in the Senate and didn't happen and hasn't happened. Who knows, maybe we'll revisit that at the federal level, but I will say that, you know, at the federal level, this has been done statutorily. Now, the sponsor and others may very well point out that, look where it's gotten the federal government. We are not better off today than we were 35 years ago in terms of the national debt the federal budget deficit. Lower interest rates have been helpful in terms of lowering the borrowing costs that we've experienced in the last few years, but the national debt is much larger today than it was in 1980, and some would say a balanced budget amendment in 1995 would have made a big difference. Others would say that there have been tax policy changes along the way that have helped to put us where we are. Others would point to federal entitlement spending, and the answer is, of course, it's all of the above. Growth certainly helps, but we haven't. I mean, we just have not seen, either in Missouri or nationally, in the last 15 years, the kind of growth that we saw in the mid to late 1990s.
You know, one of the concerns that I have, as I've seen over the last decade now, increasing cuts to our existing programs. We've had just a lot of our safety net programs. And it's just been a policy decision that this legislature has made, and that's fine. I mean, if that's where they go, that's where they go. One of the problems that I've seen, Senator, is that then we are turning to our local municipalities, our counties, our nonprofits to kind of pick up where the state left off.
Pass the buck to the
and
local level.
I guess part of one of my concerns that I have is my city is always seems willing to kind of rise to the occasion. When we cut funding for health care, you know, my city comes in and says, okay, we're going to provide safety net health care. When we cut funding for public safety, you know, kind of on and on and on.
Right.
But then on the local level, and those, you know, folks will say, you know, you choose to live there, that's your problem. But then what's happening is that our sales taxes are going up and up and up and up and up.
Yep.
And we're asked increasingly to vote in all of these sales tax and property tax increases and other things to pay for things that the state used to take care of. And my concern is that this is going to increase more of that, that this is more of sort of a forcing it to the local folks. What's your perspective on
that? Well, you know, to his credit, I think the sponsor acknowledged that we've seen sales tax increases at the local level. And we were talking about the state elimination of the state sales tax on groceries, and you know, that hasn't translated to the local level. And I'll tell you, in my region, we have seen county after county adopt a local sales tax to support children's services and some mental health functions. And I think at this point, I believe St. Charles County, Jefferson County, City of St. Louis, I think St. Louis County actually may have been the last one of those in the region to adopt it. I think they did so in 2008 or 2010. But the point is, voters in those counties, or the city not within a county, are now paying higher sales taxes to cover functions that used to be taken care of by the state, or at least funded at a higher level by the state. And so what has happened is you have seen, once again, the burden of government functions shifted from the state level, where it's leveraged by all of the state, to the local level, where each community is out for its own. And what that has meant in the major metropolitan areas is, in effect, higher local taxes and, admittedly, the services that come with it. And, you know, the question is, you know, federal versus state versus local, a lot of this stuff is going to get done somewhere, or maybe worse, it's not. And particularly for areas like mental health and children's services, at times, we could be penny wise and pound foolish. When we don't make the investments we need to in those services, eventually as a society we're going to end up paying for it somewhere else. And that's part of the Medicaid debate too.
Well, and it is. And, you know, it's interesting. Last night we were trying to pass a bill, and we did, out of the Judiciary Committee, that had to do with local ordinance fees for domestic violence shelters. Right now,
right.
If a local, you know, domestic, or if a local city or county wants to, they can take advantage of voting to put a $2 fee on every criminal ordinance violation that comes through. And the domestic violence shelters have come back and said, hey, if our local municipality wants to vote and increase that up to $4, can we have them do that? So we were discussing that, and one of the questions that came up is, you know, why do the domestic violence shelters need this? Why do they need $4 now instead of $2? And the answer is because they are turning away more people now than they are allowing into their doors. So more women and children are now seeking services than are able to get the services. And so it's a crisis. And so the question came up, well, why is that? Are there fewer domestic violence shelters or is there more need? And the answer is there's more of a need. Well, why is there more of a need? Well, there's a whole host of reasons why there's a need. But one of the things is because we have so significantly cut back on any mental health care that is available in this state. And when you start slashing services like that, you're creating problems that could be resolved on a very low-cost level, on a local low-cost level.
Yep.
And you are kind of kicking the can down the road, so they say. And I know that this is just a fundamental disagreement that we would have with folks who are in favor of this piece of legislation.
Sure.
But the problem is as I see it, is we could spend smaller amounts of money in more targeted, effective ways and not have to then do the bigger ticket items on the other end.
I agree. And those bigger ticket items are extensive. I mean, it goes to increase law enforcement costs, increase, in some cases, increased correction costs, increased health care costs. And, you know, particularly where you're talking about, you know, situations that require interventional treatment, sometimes you're not intervening at a point where the cost of care and correction is lower and more sustainable, and instead waiting until things are more intractable and thus much more expensive to address. And, you know, if we're talking about what keeps the most tax dollars in people's pockets, it's making wise strategic investments with the tax dollars that we have. And when we put in place an arbitrary measure of what we can do for children, what we can do in our schools, what we can do for the sick, what we can do for the mentally ill, what we can do as a state, we limit our ability to make those wise strategic investments. Because, take an example, mental health. For all of this, there is a certain cost inherent in maintaining the delivery structure.
Sure.
There's a fixed cost in having these services available and accessible, and in some cases, it's a considerable cost. And so when you fail to make that investment, you lose your ability. You don't just lose the incremental, it's not always the difference between turning away more women that come in for domestic violence than you're allowed to admit. Sometimes you lose the center. Sometimes you lose them all. It just goes back to the point. We are unduly limiting our ability to make those important strategic investments in our people. And that is my concern with this SJR.
And I agree with those concerns, and I echo those concerns. You know, Senator, I noticed that you were on the committee that heard this bill. Is that correct?
I was not on the committee that heard this bill. I don't believe
you were not.
Was it Ways and Means?
Yeah.
Oh, it was Ways and Means. Okay. Yeah. That's right. I apologize. How quickly
my report said you voted no on it.
Yeah, I did vote no. Yeah, I apologize.
Do you know if you were at that committee hearing? I don't know if you remember it or not. The reason why I'm asking is I was looking at the witnesses who testified in favor and against it, and most of the folks I can kind of see where they were coming from. The one that kind of surprised me a little bit is the Missouri Hospital Association.
What was their take?
Any memory why they testified against it? I don't know why you would remember that, but.
Well, I will say, for what it's worth, and as the minority caucus leader, I know that you coordinate the appointments of various caucus members to different committees, and you were very accommodating as a freshman senator of all of my requests. But one of the results of granting me all of my wishes is that on Thursday mornings I have appropriations and Ways and Means and Health and Veterans that all meet at substantially the same time.
Oh, okay.
And I will tell you, part of the challenge of this business is learning how to be in three places at once. And I have excellent interns, a fantastic policy director, and I've actually been able to do it better than I might have expected. But I will confess that from time to time, there may be some witness testimony that I don't get to hear in one room because I'm in one of two others on Thursday mornings.
I totally understand. I have been in the same boat. Before I was the minority leader, the previous minority leader assigned me to, I think, every committee standing, every joint, every special, every blue task, every statutory. I was on every committee all at once.
That was awfully thoughtful of him. He obviously trusted your
No, he just didn't like me. And that's a joke. No, but at one point I remember someone just innocently said to me, you know, how many committees you're on? I'm like, that's a good question. Let me count. It was something like 26 committees. Yeah. And so the first thing that I did when I became minority leader, guess what it was? I took myself off all of those committees, and I shared the wealth with nine and now eight of my closest friends. You guys get to carry this torch now. I've done it now for, you know, however many years.
Well, Senator, I greatly appreciate and forgive me for using a turn of phrase that has become embedded in our popular lexicon, but thank you for spreading the wealth around in that regard, Senator.
It's my pleasure. I was happy to do that. And I did specifically try to do it so that people didn't have conflicts, but as you might imagine, when you've only got 10 people and then 9 people, you start to have to just throw conflicts out the window and hope for the best.
So. No, I appreciate that. I will say it's gone more smoothly than I might have feared, but that said, if I seem to be failing to recall a particular witness testifying against this bill, that might possibly be the explanation for it, or it may just be that I simply don't remember, which can happen as well. But I'll say this. I mean, I don't remember as I stand here.
That's fine.
What objections were raised by that particular group, and I know we try not to couch things in those terms on the floor of the Senate anyway, but
I was looking through and I kind of got it. I noticed like the Kansas City Civic Council, they testified against it. That doesn't surprise me. One of their biggest priorities is education.
Right.
And I know that they would have the same concerns that I raised earlier about our ability to fully fund K through 12 education. And frankly, I'm one who thinks we should be funding pre-K through 12.
No, I strongly agree. And I I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that the Missouri Hospital Association might have been concerned about health care funding
in
couching its testimony on this particular SJR before the Ways and Means Committee. But like I said, I don't recall, but I'm going to guess that might have been their concern, particularly when they've been, as have many others across our state throughout the business community, talking about the importance of Medicaid expansion. I know that's one group that has also been part of that. So, and I'll say in that regard, for those of us, and we may be outnumbered, but for those of us who believe that we can do better than just saying no to Medicaid expansion or Medicaid reform in our state, I'm concerned, again, that this SJR would substantially curtail our ability to go in that direction. I mean, it's an appropriation limit, so it doesn't only, and I could be wrong here, I think the appropriation growth limit doesn't just apply. This is an important point. It doesn't just apply to state funds. Now, it does talk about net general revenue collection, so that is a state concept. It's probably worth taking a minute to discern whether Tabor would effectively prevent us from appropriating additional federal funds. For instance, a Medicaid eligibility expansion match, or the Reinvestment and Recovery Act funds that were appropriated by Congress in 2009 that had the effect. I mean, don't get me wrong, we had some awfully tough budget years just in the last few years still, but without question, absent the Reinvestment and Recovery Act money that came into the state, we certainly would have been much worse off in the last downturn, and we would have had even deeper cuts to education, K-12 education, higher education, health care, mental health, other important state services, transportation. Maybe not transportation as much, but who knows what we would have had to have done.
Sure.
I mean, we were talking about a major hole in state government that the Reinvestment and Recovery Act dollars only partially managed to fill over a period of almost 5 years. And we still had difficult budget years on the back end of that. And so if our ability to appropriate federal funds would be compromised, that would be an additional reason to approach now oppose the SJR. Now, I see that we talk about total state general revenue appropriations in sub 4, and we talk about total state general revenue appropriations in sub 5. So it may very well be that federal appropriations are not contemplated within the scope of this SJR. Now, I'll tell you, I might get some relief out of that. There may be some other members of the body that would suggest that we need to fix that too and prohibit that. But there just have been times in the past and going forward where federal dollars matter. They certainly matter for transportation purposes.
Senator, I appreciate this inquiry. I have, at 6:05, promised to do something off the floor. I know that the senator from the 7th had wanted to ask a question, I believe, and I want to give him the opportunity to do that, but I need to run off real fast.
Why don't I let you do that? Thank you for the inquiry, Senator.
Thank you, Senator.
Mr. President, may I inquire of the senator from the 7th?
Senator from the 7th is approaching his desk. Does the senator yield to an inquiry?
I do.
He does. Proceed, Senator.
Told you have something on your mind. Whatever is it?
Well, Senator, I've been listening to the debate, and I don't think that we've properly addressed why the state of Colorado rolled back this measure. They were the only state in the entire nation who passed it, who put it on the ballot and passed it, and then there was a group of leaders, civic leaders, who then returned to the effort to repeal it, or to suspend it, is what
right.
they did. And I didn't know if you had any more information about what the numbers were or anything at all that would suggest that the experiment had failed.
Well, I don't with me. I will suggest, you mentioned Colorado. That's a state that's undertaken some other experiments as well. May not be the only one. But
they're a laboratory for democracy.
They are, and heaven only knows what else they might be revisiting in years to come. You and I, we have many issues of the day on which we agree that might be some of what Colorado has done. You in other policy areas, you and I might disagree on.
Maybe.
That's okay.
Maybe not before it's all over before it's all said and done.
As long as you mean that for yourself as much as for me, we'll see how things play out. But I am, I'll just say it this way, I am skeptical of certain policy changes that our friends in Colorado and maybe the state of Washington have undertaken. And I'll leave it at that for now.
I can't help but notice that you and I are, and the senator from the 11th, are the last three standing.
Well, two of us are standing.
Yeah, two of us are standing.
If the senator from the 11th had a special guest, we would have all three senators on the floor currently standing. I do see the senator from the 4th is still with us.
I can recognize Mr. Martin up in the upper galleries. There's some special introductions that we could do.
Oh, well, I wouldn't want to put him on the spot like that, although maybe a constituent of yours. Certainly not of the senator from the 11th.
Here's something else that I wanted to talk to you about. So you know that I'm a big fan of Jon Stewart and The Daily Show, and I watch it pretty much every night that I have the opportunity to. So, and one of the nights, he was talking about Governor Chris Christie had been lobbying on Capitol Hill for emergency funding for Hurricane Sandy.
Yep.
And I think the number was $36 billion thereabout. It was a very significant number that he was advocating for. And Jon Stewart made the point that, you know, when it's a natural disaster, it's an emergency, and it's okay to go and ask for those types of funds. But when it comes to expanding Medicaid or providing health care for individuals, if you are the individual who is diagnosed with terminal cancer, isn't that an emergency for you? I mean, doesn't that rise to the level of anything the weather is going to do as an individual? And somehow we categorize and classify a difference between an appropriation when it helps the individual versus when it helps the collective. And I looked at this bill and I saw in the first section the definition of emergency. Emergency means an event or series of events or a state of affairs that requires the immediate appropriation of money for health, safety, and the general welfare of the people. Now, just reading that passage, you would think that protecting our citizens' access to medical care would fall directly square into that language. Would you have a different reading of that provision?
I would not.
So if we're saying an emergency, an immediate appropriation of monies for health, safety, and general welfare, I'm having a hard time understanding why we're debating a measure that would reduce our ability to provide the consistent services for those three activities. Because on any given day, one of our citizens is going to have an emergency. They're going to get a piece of news that is going to fundamentally change their life. And by us reducing our ability to address those daily emergencies, we are doing a disservice to the people that we represent. And somehow in this language we have justified or categorized the difference between what an emergency is on that level versus what an emergency is for the individual. And too often we don't put the citizen at the center of our discussions. We don't value what happens on a day-to-day basis to the individual. We always talk in this 30,000-foot ethereal manner, and then we somehow justify our actions based on the differences between those two. And I would just contend that if you are one of those individuals that had an unfortunate circumstance of having catastrophic health news provided to you, that that indeed is an emergency, and that this bill reduces our ability to address those emergencies.
I strongly agree.
So I'm, you know, we talked about the tax cut earlier, and we can discuss some of those arguments that we had there. We've got an education formula that's underfunded. We've got transportation obligations that by 2017 we're going to be $180 million unable to meet the simple safety requirements of our existing roadways and bridges. And we're trying to advance legislation that would further hamper our ability to provide those services to the citizenry. How is that fiscal responsibility?
I strongly agree. I think it is improvidently and ill-advisedly shackling our ability to do what we need to do when we need to do it. Times change, and the demands on our budget changes over time. And by, in essence, adopting a one-way ratchet that allows revenue to decrease but never increase, apart from CPI, which is insufficient to keep up with inflation in education and healthcare, especially higher education, I am fearful that we are going to undermine the very institutions and the very service delivery systems, transportation, health, mental health, education.
Alzheimer's funding.
Yeah, that allow us.
Meals on wheels.
Well, that allow us to compete in the economy, higher education especially, good health care for working people. Those are things that help somebody get back to work or get a better job or advance in life, improve themselves, be better educated. All things that are absolutely critical to competing in a 21st century global economy. And by saying that we're going to systematically over time strip our investments in our people, in our workforce, in the health of our workforce, to say nothing of our retirees and some of the recipients of things that you mentioned, Alzheimer's funding,
mental health funding, meals on wheels,
mental health, you know, we are going to limit not just, in the case of those folks, you're talking about some people's ability to be a consumer.
Let me, first off, we can help businesses create jobs, but if we don't have an educated, skilled labor force to move into those jobs, then the job is worthless.
Right.
And I think that we are limiting our ability and our state's ability to generate that workforce that makes us competitive for businesses to want to be in Missouri. So from that standpoint,
right,
this is going to constrict that activity. But I don't know if you know, one of the things that in other legislative priorities that I've been working on, one of the stark statistics that we have uncovered, or I wouldn't say uncovered, but have been renewed interest in 1970, the Department of Corrections budget in the state of Missouri, do you have any idea how much it was? Do you care to take a guess?
I don't.
It was $9.8 million. 1970, Department of Corrections, state of Missouri, $9.8 million. Would you care to guess what percentage of the overall GR or the overall appropriation that 9.8 represented?
I'm not going to guess.
1.5%. So in 1970, we spent $10 million on corrections.
Yep.
It was 1.5% of the budget. Do you know what it is in 2012?
I've got the budget book sitting on my desk downstairs.
Right,
we're about to go through it. But I will say this. I think we spent almost four times that on just food for inmates now as a state.
So in 2012... our correction budget was $588 million. The percentage of the budget that ate up was almost 8%.
Yep.
7% plus. So from 1970, it was $9.8 million and 1.5% of the budget, to 2012, it was $588 million and almost 8% of the budget. Now, my problem is why right. that is the case, but that's a debate for another day.
Sure.
The fact of the matter is that it still occurred. And if you believe that our criminal justice system is important, that's just another evidentiary example of how this bill would constrict our ability to meet the obligations that we have as a state.
And let me say this. Under our criminal justice system, when somebody needs to be in the Department of Corrections, they need to be in the Department of Corrections. And if the reason that we have seen a growth in correction is because we have seen an increase in crime and an increase in our ability to solve crime and an increase in our rate of successful prosecution, then that's the way it needs to be.
Well,
the concern is this, though. When you have crime arising out of other societal conditions that are preventable by investments in other areas, most especially education or economic development, then, yeah, we really are being penny-wise, pound-foolish in not making the investments we need to make in those areas. I strongly agree with that. That said, if somebody breaks the law, commits a felony, needs to be locked up, that's where they need to go.
Well, I just use that as one example of how government grows despite intentions. It grows. And if we didn't add another person onto the Medicaid rolls this year, because it doesn't look like expansion is going to happen this year, if that doesn't happen and we're unsuccessful in drawing down those federal dollars, the current existing MoHealthNet system, as constrictive as it is, still grows.
Well, I remain hopeful that we will get something done on Medicaid reformation, including changes to eligibility levels in Missouri.
I completely
this year,
agree with you.
And I'm hopeful we'll get something done on taxes as well. I've said that. I know not everybody on either side of the aisle agrees with me on, in some cases they might disagree with me on both of those concepts. But
the problem
is,
and I bring that up because the obligations and the resources available are not mutually exclusive. This bill is not fiscally responsible if you're going to uphold the commitments that you have on the other obligations that are already in place.
Education.
Transportation.
Even
health.
Debt service, potentially.
Mental health funding, all of our social service programs.
Yep.
And so if you were of the philosophy or the mindset that those programs are ineffective and your effort is to dismantle those programs, then this bill is fine because you don't have the inconsistency of funding. But if you believe that those programs do serve a purpose and they do help our citizens and that people wake up every single day and rely on, especially if you're a senior citizen and you're homebound and Meals on Wheels has been assisted or you have Alzheimer's funding. I remember in 2008 or 2009, I was in the House. I had a couple whose funding was cut from Alzheimer's. They didn't know what they were going to do. They didn't know where they were going to go. You know, that's a scary place to be. And if you feel that government has a role in assisting the most vulnerable, I'm not talking about assisting the able body that we argue about, whether they should or they shouldn't, take advantage of the inefficiencies of a welfare system. I'm talking about the most vulnerable citizens. You are putting them in jeopardy.
Yes.
And that, to me, rather you're a Democrat or Republican, I believe we can agree that the most vulnerable, those who need the assistance should be there for them. That's why society works. That's what makes us different from third world countries. And that's why we have a stable and an order about our civilization as a whole that has subsisted for, you know, 240 years and will continue to subsist in the future because we care about each other and we invest in each other and we build this community together and we do use public resources to do that.
Well, and I want to be clear because sometimes when people like you and I talk about the importance of maintaining those investments, it can come across as suggesting that public resources ought to be the only means by which that's done. And I neither you nor I agree with that.
No.
I mean, there is an important place, some would say a much more important place, for nonprofit and
charitable organizations. Faith-based organizations.
Absolutely, faith-based organizations.
My church does a lot of good work in the area of helping vulnerable citizens. We have Christmas
yes.
in October where we pick three houses of senior citizens that we get together and help with maintenance. You know, it can be as simple as fixing a handrail, but that makes a difference for a senior citizen who can't do that.
But I will tell you, when we're talking, let me talk about a case in point of public resources for something along those lines. We've got the state tax credit for food pantries. That's something that I've been trying to increase the authorization on, especially if we get, you know, somewhere toward comprehensive tax credit reform this year. I'd like to see some room for that credit to grow over time. And you know who I hear from on that? I hear from constituents and people that I know who are activists in the faith community for that. And these are folks that provide nonprofit religious food pantry services to people throughout my metropolitan region. And they appreciate the fact that we need to have both. We need to have both charitable access to charitable food pantries, but that a use of public resources in the form of a tax credit can help leverage that, right, and can help these private 501c3 organizations do a more effective job at the important services they're already trying to provide. It's not a formal public-private partnership, but it's an instance where public resources are used to help nonprofits be more effective. And I think that is an eminently, especially when you're talking about something like food for the needy, I think that is an eminently appropriate appropriation of state resources. Now, it's technically, we're talking about a tax credit in that case, and it raises a question whether under Tabor, the appropriation limit includes tax credits or not, or if it's just general revenue appropriations. I'm willing to bet the answer to that lies in the definition of general revenue, and let's just take it, or the general revenue, net general revenue collection. All revenue deposited into the GR, less refunds and revenues originally deposited to the general revenue but designated by law for a specific distribution or transfer to another state fund as reported by the Office of Administration. As I read that, I'm not certain if that captures tax credits, but when it says less refunds,
that's a good point.
I just don't know standing here.
I mean, not reforming the tax credit system and having this, that could be a real disaster, because you never know what the tax credit refunds are going to be year to year. They've grown. I can't remember a year where they've not grown.
Yeah.
Since I've been in here, I know the senator from the 12th is passionate about tax credit reform. He has been very public about his position on wanting to rein in some of that spending. So I'm just not sure having a bill like this pass and not having that type of tax credit reform is, again, a recipe,
you know,
for good social science.
As I stand here, one thing that you or I might want to do is see if maybe we could do something to clarify whether net general revenue collections includes tax credits. Maybe a clarifying amendment is something that could be in order. I mean, I know the sponsor may say, well, clearly it does or doesn't include tax credits in the net general revenue collection, but maybe that's something we could look at as we continue the as yet only nascent debate of this particular SJR.
Well, what I'm interested in, and if you want, do you want to take a second? I can inquire of the Senator of the 11th if you would like to take a minute to see if you can't.
You know, actually, why don't I do this? Why don't I spring you for a minute? I've been standing here for a little while, and I have been curious as I've stood here what the senator from the 11th's take is on all of this. And so why don't I inquire of him?
I'll tell you what, also, before we leave this discussion, I think it would be prudent to hear from the senator from Boone.
Really?
Or the senator from Clay. Sure. Because they're the ones, the senator from Boone currently, the senator from Clay, perhaps in the future, will be the ones who have to sort out what happens with this. So I think it would be a good idea to maybe hear from them as well.
Well, and I appreciate that. I will say that I serve on the Appropriations Committee, and they happen to be the chair and the vice chair of that committee now, with the senator from the 2nd leaving the Senate last week. And this is the week that the Senate Appropriations Committee has the budget. And so members of the committee are spending hours at the markup table on that. Those two are spending a whole lot more time than the rest of us, I suspect. It's an immense amount of work and responsibility. We're fortunate to have the two of them doing the task. They're probably the two most experienced budget committee members.
Which is why they would be
building
the appropriate person or persons, senators, to
sure
hear from on the implications of what this means for future budget growth. Before I leave you, let's go back. Now, do you want me to work with staff on trying to...
Yeah, let's clarify whether this includes tax credit. The sponsor may be able to tell you whether that's a helpful clarification or not. I mean, it might be worth checking with the sponsor.
We can offer an amendment.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That would certainly clarify it. Certainly. Tell me again where in the...
The basic question is on page 2 of the SJR, sub 4, whether net general revenue collections includes or excludes tax credits. If you think that tax credits ought to be excluded and the state should have more ability to appropriate through tax credits, then you could exclude them. On the other hand, if you want to make sure that tax credit spending doesn't go running amok, you might want to include that in the net general revenue collection.
I will talk to staff about this. The other thing that I would suggest that we maybe flush out a little bit is when does emergency apply? If Joplin happens, we have $150 million of cleanup, how does that process work? Does the city of Joplin apply then for emergency status? Do the appropriators do that? What happens in the event that another...
And are we really sure that we want to have to get two-thirds in both houses? Maybe a simple majority or four-sevenths, or I don't know. Right. Maybe two-thirds is right. Maybe it's seven-eighths. I don't know. Maybe one-third. There are a lot of different ways you could approach
it. Well, give me a minute to talk to our staff here.
I'll let you do that. With that, Mr. President, may I inquire the senator from the 11th?
Senator from the 11th, do you yield to inquiry?
I do.
Proceed, senators.
Senator, you have been sitting at your desk during the entire time that this SJR has been on the floor, unless I don't have eyes in the back of my head, so if you slipped away for a moment, I didn't notice. But I want to first thank you for listening very carefully to the discussion that we've had to this point, and I can only imagine that insofar as you have done so, you may have had the opportunity to form some views yourself of this SJR, and I might just ask you what your take is on all this, Senator.
Well, I have an interesting background on this because I came into this building with the senator from Andrews. And I think the first year that he was here, he introduced this, and I got to be on that committee to hear this. So every year I've been down here, which is 10 years now, 2 years when I wasn't in office, this idea has come up.
Right.
And what is interesting about this idea is it is proposed as a way to limit government, but what I see what it does, it limits elected officials' ability to make decisions on behalf of the people of their state. Colorado did this, then they put a freeze on it because it tied their hands too much. And the real harm of this is not necessarily what has been reported as the benefit of it. The real harm is that you're telling future legislators not to use resources that they believe is best for the state.
And that would only come into the Treasury through existing tax policy.
That's right. That's exactly correct. And so the revenues that we have with this constitutional amendment, it would limit how much future General Assemblies could spend, but there may be an opportunity, maybe a reason that we can't even foresee that they would need to spend it on. And the other idea behind this is that we need to do this because of this growth in state government. Senator, we're sitting in a state government that in the 90s was booming, and we put together a Hancock Amendment, then cut taxes Now we're in a situation where we don't have a fully funded foundation formula. And Senator, if you remember, the foundation formula was created around 2005.
Plus or minus a year.
Okay. Yeah. Well, there was a foundation formula before that wasn't funded beginning in 2002.
Right.
So we're not funding a foundation formula that has been lowered since this time, right?
And to that point, the fully funded formula, were it fully funded under the current formula, would be, I believe, a number that is itself almost $600 million lower than what would have been called for under the prior formula, at least in the first year of its adoption. So we defined downward what full funding meant, and then we underfunded The watered down rendition of full funding.
Exactly. And so we have that. We also have an issue with the way we fund our roads and other transportation issues. You know, the House passed a bill or a resolution similar to what we talked about last session that would increase taxes to fund our needs for our roads. And so that would go to a vote of the people, a 1 cent sales tax. So we're not funding schools, we're not funding roads, we're not going to decide to pull down our federal tax money that everybody in this state pays to help cover people with health care and build businesses, but we still have a problem. Now, I would contend that all of these problems that I would say are problems happen because a General Assembly has said that that's how the direction they want to go, right?
Right.
So this idea that, we need to have a constitutional amendment to lower the growth of spending, when in truth, we've seen the lower growth of spending because elected officials have done that, right?
Absolutely.
And so it doesn't make sense to put an arbitrary constitutional amendment on that will hurt the future legislators from making decisions. I don't agree with those decisions. I've been in the minority for 10 years. I would do it in a different way. I would follow the lead of states with growth, even though, you know, we talk about, you mentioned that we don't have as many congressional seats, we don't have as many growth. Well, one of the two biggest states I can think of that have grown, Senator, is California and Florida. And they
California is now losing population.
What?
California, I believe, is now actually losing population.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah. I realized, I guess since 1900 they've grown, though.
Absolutely.
I don't
Without
know
question.
How we're,
yeah.
When we're beginning when we're beginning how we do it. But people have moved through, in Arizona has grown.
Yep.
People have moved,
yep.
Right?
My mother moved to Arizona. My mother added to the state population by one.
So there's different varying reasons of why Missouri doesn't have the 16 congressional districts that we used to have.
Right.
Very different reasons.
Yep.
You can look at a state like New York that has a lot of them. You know, they tax a little bit more than we do. They fund a little bit more of the infrastructure than we do. Is that an approach we want to do? California has all kinds. They have a petition initiative that makes ours look even conservative. Do we want to go that route? So this idea that we want to try to continue to do what other states have done just in the terms of growth doesn't seem to make sense to me. Because my guess is if we wanted to follow some of the states that grew, we could come up with some ideas that a lot of people in this body would not like us to do.
Sure, sure. You know, forgive me for interrupting you.
You're
aware.
No.
There's a member.
I'd start talking, so.
There's a member of this body who claims to be the tallest senator ever to have served in this body. You've heard that claim, have you not?
Yes.
And you're fairly tall yourself.
I believe that claim.
Why? Because that may be.
Because I think if that claim is correct, which has not been disputed, that makes me the second tallest person ever.
There's actually been some very good dissertation on that subject, and it appears that there, at least one journalist has suggested lately that there may be some dispute of that. But I want to suggest that our doormen have been doing a fantastic job of making sure that I remain adequately hydrated during the course of the proceedings today. And I am going to suggest that I have the tallest stack of styrofoam cups ever to be on the desk of one senator accrued in any one debate in the history of the Senate. And at this point, the stack is 5 cups tall. I have a 6-cup that's full with water, and you'll appreciate that I'm not in a huge hurry to get through that, but I now have 6 cups on my desk, and I think that that is the tallest stack that we have ever seen in this chamber.
It's the tallest one I've seen, Senator.
It's the tallest one we see right now, certainly.
Yes.
Heaven forbid that I should start any kind of an arms race that would lead to senators trying to one-up me on that. I'm not using a prop, Mr. President. I'm simply pointing to a stack of things on my desk. I appreciate that I'm approaching the line. And speaking of our tallest senator in history, I note that the chair has what I guess is referred to as a backup gavel or a spare gavel. I don't know if you saw that earlier today, but when we came into session this afternoon, I distinctly heard the Secretary of the Senate implore the senator presiding at the start of this afternoon's session, who happened to be our tallest senator, not to bang the gavel as hard as he possibly could, which he, of course, then did. And as a result, the head on the gavel, the mallet part that hits the striker, could be heard audibly hitting the floor of dais when it fell off of the handle.
Goodness.
And that's why we're stuck with our backup gavel for the rest of the evening.
I didn't realize that happened.
It happened. It happened loudly, and I will suggest that I have never seen the Secretary of the Senate glare at me quite the way that she may have glared at the presiding officer.
Well, that is Senate
after
property.
That chain of events, but what's that?
It is Senate property.
It
I
is.
Mean, it's important.
Taxpayer property.
Taxpayer property, and we don't want to waste any taxpayer money for recklessness, that's for sure.
We do not, but I will say it was very impressive. It was very possibly the loudest strike that I've heard. Certainly much louder than when the momentarily left-handed senator from Johnson was feebly attempting to gavel down somebody with his non-dominant hand, with his dominant hand in a sling. That was just maybe about a month ago. That was really pretty underwhelming, I thought.
Yeah, no, I think the senator from 8th is interested in using the new gavel for something, but we'll try to keep to the rules and continue on with our discussion for this. But, you know...
So just for the record, yeah. Before we get back to the debate, tallest stack of cups in the Senate ever, right here.
Probably the tallest I've seen, Senator.
Appreciate that. But they are all approved Senate cups.
Yes, they're all approved. That's good. So there's no gaveling of you.
Let's go back to Tabor, and yes. I want to address
the
topic.
This is a Tabor, right? I mean...
Yeah.
It's Tabor, short for Tex, Payer's Bill of Rights, and there's only one state that passed it, has ever passed it, and it's Colorado.
And that's the same state as one of two states that have only ever legalized certain Schedule One drugs.
Right, and then they pulled it back. So, not really a proven track record of reducing revenues at all.
Well, I do want to talk about a specific issue in Missouri government, and I think it's one that you're concerned about as well, and that is state employee pay.
Yes.
And I have not seen the numbers recently, but I was told as recently as within the last year, maybe before the pay increase that we adopted in the last year's regular session, that our public employees, our state employees, were the 50th out of 50 in the nation in terms of their pay scale. And that, again, there may be some dispute of that. I've heard that, all right? And I've heard that from more than one place. And again, there's a debate over what the appropriate approach is. I'm happy to see what we did in appropriations last year to try to help rectify that. This year, we're talking about increasing state employee pay, although I don't think by the same amount as last year. But my concern with it is this. If at some point in the future, the people that stand in this room and the people that deliberate across the building in the House should decide that maybe we don't want to be number 50 or 49 or 48 or whatever we are in state employee pay, and we want to do something about that. We want to be 25, or we want to be 35, or we want to be 45.
Right.
If this SJR is the law of the state, their ability to appropriate and to grow. To try to close that gap would be limited to CPI.
Yes.
The most, if we put all of our new revenue growth into state employee pay, even that would be capped by CPI for any given year. You'd never be able to get from 50 to 45 if you wanted
That's right.
Less 35 or 25.
And as the proponents of this Tabor say, well, we have to do it to limit. Well, we've done a pretty good job. We've limited the pay of state employees to the 50. We've done that. This is what the General Assembly has done over years. We've limited and reduced the number of state employees. I think the governor during the State of the State said since his term started, 2,000 less state employees. Well, if you're reducing the size of state government, in that way, then what's the, why do you need this? That's really the crux of the argument I have. Why would you need something like this? I think maybe the proponents of this want you to want to go further, but they're able to go further. The people of the state elect representatives and senators all the way through to make these decisions, and I would say that the people have decided that in our state we want basically low taxes, we want government to be as small and efficient as possible, but we don't want radical things that hurt our schools, hurt our roads, and that's why you don't have, that's why this body and others have not passed anything like this, because it's artificial.
You know, different states have different policy values, and let the record reflect, I have now added a sixth cup to the stack, and I'm being served a seventh by our hardworking doorman, courtesy of the presiding officer, which I greatly appreciate. I suspected for a moment that he was trying to bait me into drinking from the stack of six approved cups. My concern being, we have an unwritten rule in the Senate here people may not be familiar with. You can only drink from approved cups. And I'm concerned that if I were to attempt to drink from a stack of six cups, that might not be an approved cup, and that might get me gaveled by the spare gavel. And so,
are you
going to
recycle those, Senator? Is that why you're keeping them? There is a every Senate desk has a trash.
You know, I'm not the senator from the seventh, but I'm not so sure about recycling styrofoam.
Okay.
I mean, you might have to ask him about
why
that.
Never
I think he's probably still trying to figure out how we change 2/3 to 1/8 or something.
It does look strange why you'd be keeping them, but maybe you were going to reuse them or something.
Well, I just just in case it ever winds up in the Guinness Book of World Records, what the tallest stack of styrofoam cups in the Missouri Senate while in session ever happened to be. Could grow to seven here soon, but back to Tabor.
Yes.
You know, I have always been of the view, different states have different values, but when it comes to employee pay, I think that the per capita tax base is something that you should look to as a guideline. And let me give you a specific case in point. When I first was elected to the Afton Board of Education in 2001, our teacher pay out of approximately 25 districts in St. Louis County, 23 school districts in St. Louis County, our teacher pay, depending on whether you had your bachelor's or your master's plus 30, and depending on how long you had taught, what step you were on in the pay scale, by and large, most of our teachers were either last out of 23 in the county or next to last out of 23 in the county. Now, there were some other benefits.
How many school districts are in your county?
I believe it's 23, depending on how you classify the special school district. And, of course, we've attrited one lapsing in accreditation, and we might soon have one less, depending on what happens with our friends.
How big is the school district? How many pupils are in that school district?
2,500. 2,500,
okay.
And the thing about it was, our assessed valuation per pupil, which is the metric that is used in the foundation formula to allocate educational dollars, out of those 23 districts, our assessed valuation per pupil was number 11. And our income per capita for the taxpaying citizenry was number 13 out of 23, okay. Which is to say, we had a much larger tax base than we were paying our teachers.
Right.
It took three contracts. It took 7 years. But when I left the Board of Education, most of our teachers in the district were within 1% on either side of county median for teacher pay for their level of degree attainment and their years of seniority. It's hard. The median's a constantly moving target, and it's 30 different numbers depending on your seniority and your educational attainment. But substantially all of our employees were basically right there, and it took a lot of investment from the community to make that happen. But I will tell you today, Afton, which is in the middle of the pack in assessed valuation per pupil and in local income, is at 95% on MSIP cycle 5.
Okay.
In an environment where their free and reduced lunch population has increased, it's not as many other districts have to have, but long story short, we're doing a really good job educating kids. We've been accredited with distinction. I think at this point it's 6 years running and maybe 8 out of the last 10. And state employee pay, teacher pay, happened in the run-up to that occurring. And I was always of the view that you want to recruit the best possible faculty, and you always want to retain your faculty. And I think that that has paid educational dividends to the people of Afton, and I'm very proud of that.
I think there's a lot of lessons in that story as it concerns with Tabor. As a community, you decided to spend more money to improve your schools. As an elected official, you in your board decided to go ahead and make those investments and not be hamstringed by some rule to do that. You also, if I'm right, Senator, you didn't decide to pay him the highest in this county either. So you're fiscally responsible with making sure that you're paying what makes sense and what makes sense for the taxpayers, but also what makes sense for your employees
our assessed
to get
valuation,
the best quality out.
Yes, our assessed valuation and local income were in the middle of the pack. I just didn't think it made sense for our teacher pay to be at the bottom. I thought we should be at the middle of the pack. We got there, and the results have followed,
right.
And it's been great to see.
Which, I mean, back to the idea that we are 50th when it comes to our state employees. I mean, you made a decision on your school board to invest in teacher pay to improve the performance of your district,
yep.
And then we decide up here in Jefferson City that we're going to pay our state employees the lowest in the nation and then wonder why state government isn't efficient.
And
to, wonder why we don't have better quality people and better processes through there.
And to be clear, and I'm very serious about this, if you'd asked the teachers, they would have said, well, it's nice, it's not the most important thing to us, that working conditions are important as well.
Right.
And in many cases, they would rather have a better set of working conditions than higher pay.
Yes.
And they said
I think state workers are probably in that boat right now.
Yeah.
You know, working conditions are a huge issue.
And to be clear, it's not as if that was the only thing we did to try to increase our educational attainment in the district. We rewrote our curriculum soup to nuts to align it to grade level expectations under the MSIP testing that was done at the time, which some would say is teaching to the test, and all I would say is, well, what do you want me to do? Do you want me to fail to teach what's being tested, or do you want me to succeed in teaching what's being tested? And that's a debate that's been, you know, national on K-12 education for a long time now. But the point is, we reworked the curriculum. We pushed technology into the classroom. We went from having a computer in every building to having one in every classroom. We had an entire building get EMITS boards, and we have those in every building now as well. We did a lot of other things. Curricularly, most importantly, I think, even more important than pay. But the point is, sometimes in life you do get what you pay for. And,
that's right. And you had the ability, you didn't have a rule like this would do the state government that says you cannot spend the money that you have based on what's good for the people of the state.
If you're number 50, you better hope the 49 states ahead of you really reduce state employee pay, because that's the only way you're ever going to catch up.
Right.
If you want to. And again, fair debate to be had about that, but I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that our per capita GDP in our state is not number 50 in the country.
And let me throw this out, too, just for the just as we talk about this. There are many people in our state, I would say many people in this chamber, who believe that we should have 50th in state government for employees, and that it's a good thing that we continue to reduce state employee numbers. And that may be their opinion, Senator, but they didn't need a Tabor to make them make that decision. It's over time that this General Assembly has made that decision. There hasn't been anything to force state government to make those decisions except for elected officials who feel like they're doing what's best for the people of the state. And that's why this is not only ties the hands of people in the future, but it's so unnecessary.
I think we're on the same page, or at least close enough to it. That said, we've been talking for some time about the merits of this SGR as it is currently written. I think maybe we should try to make it better. So thank you for your inquiry, Senator. Mr. President, I have an amendment and move for its adoption.
Senator First. Has it been distributed?
It has not, and I will not close. Believe me, I will not close until it has been.
Send the amendment forward. You said you've asked for a waiver of reading. Waiver is granted. I'd like to explain your amendment.
Sure, Mr. President. What my amendment, I am concerned about tax credit reform, I know that the sponsor is as well. And so what this amendment does is it ratchets down our tax credit spending in Missouri by 5% annually until presumably, well, I guess if you keep dividing, multiplying a number times 0.95, it will always be a number greater than zero, but it will curtail our tax credit spending in the state. And I know I talked about the importance of food pantries, but I think our friends in the House in particular might be really enamored of doing this on tax credit, and I want to make sure that if this SJR gets out of the body, that it at least has a fighting chance across the hall. So with that, I move for adoption of my amendment.
Senator from the First moves for the adoption of Senate Amendment Number 1. Any discussion on Senate Amendment Number 1?
Mr. President, I would like to inquire the Senator from the 7th.
Senator First, I'd like to inquire Senator from the 7th. Do you yield?
I do.
Proceed.
So tell me a little bit about your amendment.
So my amendment basically says that the amount of tax credits that are granted in a successive budget year has to be 5% less than the amount granted in the preceding year. It's a way of reining in our tax credit spending.
Which has support.
Well, I'll tell you this. I mean, I'm a strong supporter of historic preservation and low income housing tax credits.
As am I.
And so I wouldn't want to do anything too quick on that. And, you know, I'll tell you, I mean, maybe if you keep multiplying by 95, you get to a number that's too small too fast. Maybe we'll need to look at ways we can improve my amendment now that I think about it a little bit more.
I think the point is you're being fiscally responsible.
You're
saying that if we are going to cap the amount of growth, then we have to cap the amount of spending.
Right. Well, this is a way of making sure that the trade-off between tax credit and general revenue is something that's addressed as time goes on. It would have the effect of shifting the priority from tax credit spending to other general revenue priorities over time. And I think people on both sides of the aisle, on both sides of the building, have been calling for us to do that for years now. In fact, some of the people that have been the biggest champions of it no longer serve in the body, one of whom negotiated it, used to sit at this desk and represent the 4th. But the idea here is, I mean, I think if this is the approach that we want to take in this SJR, I think whatever approach ultimately we decide to take, whether it's my amendment or an amendment to my amendment or a substitute amendment, or some other amendment. I think we need to make it very clear what the fate of tax credits is under this Tabor SJR. So whether we like this 5% reduction or whether we decide we want to take a different approach, I tell you, now that I look at my own amendment, I have some consternation about what it'll do to tax credits.
But the thing is, though, is the issuance of tax credit is an unknown quantity.
You don't know. That's a very good point, especially the ones that are uncapped. And at this point, I think we only have...
Senator from Andrew.
Mr. President, I close.
Not recognized for that motion, Senator.
I'd ask the bill be put on the informal calendar.
The bill will be laid on the informal calendar. Senator from Newton.
Mr. President, objection. We'll go to the order of business. Report to standing committees, and I have a report.
Report to standing committees. Send your report forward.
Mr. President, your committee on rules, joint... Rules, Resolutions, and Ethics, to which was referred Senate Bill Number 734, begs leave to report it has examined the same and finds that the bill has been truly perfected and that the printed copies furnished the senators are correct. Respectfully submitted, Senator Richard, Chairman.
Senator from Newton.
Congressional objection, Senator Gordon Bez, announcements.
Announcements. Announcements. Senator from Boone is recognized for an announcement.
Thank you, Mr. President. The Appropriations Committee will pick up where we left off 30 minutes from the time that we adjourn here. Thank you.
Further announcements? Seeing none, Senator from Newton.
Mr. President, no further business coming to body. I move the Senate stand adjourned under the rules.
You've heard the motion from Senator of Newton. As many are of the opinion that motion shall prevail, say aye.
Aye.
To the contrary, say no. The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. We stand adjourned.